Welcome to Create Your Bliss with Nika Annan. Today we talked with Jonathan Merritt. Jonathan Merritt is a Marakami, an initiated traditional healer in the lineage of the Huichol, Warika people of Mexico's Western Sierra Madre. Initiated in 2006, he serves his community as a healer and a ceremonial leader, keeping a monthly community sacred fire in Portland, Oregon. A poet and writer, he was the founding editor of Sacred Fire. He serves on the board of directors of Earth and Spirit Council. Jonathan is married to the naturopath and acupuncturist Jennifer Means. They have three children. Welcome, Jonathan. Jonathan comes to us tonight from tending a fire, so you will hear in the background him taking care of the fire. So what is it that you do, and why are you tending a fire?
Well, I guess you'd have to start with the fact that I'm a Marakami, that I'm an initiated traditional healer.
Mm-hmm.
Tending a fire is one of the things that we do on a monthly basis to, increase our connection with the fire in particular, which is the guiding elemental being in our tradition, and also with the living world. Everything that's around us so when I'm tending the fire, then I'm sitting here with the fire and with the living world, and of course the dogs and chickens and whatever else might be out tonight.
And do you stay all, does it spend all night? Do you stay there all night?
Yeah, I fast during the day, so I'm fasting now, no food or water, and I stay with the fire all night long.
Uh-huh. And do people join you?
Usually not. It's actually permissible, but I prefer to spend the evening alone. It may be that my wife will join me a little later. We have some things to talk about.
Uh-huh. And so what are you feeling, thinking, praying, meditating on while you create the fire and while you tend to it?
Well, it's always a matter of learning to hear that voice which is really the voice of the heart that moves through us. And the way that fire is talked about in the Huichol tradition, mm-hmm. and in other traditions, is as the energy of heart. So As I sit with the fire, and as those who are my comrades sit with the fire, I'm listening to that and recognizing that that is speaking within me. And so trying to learn how to engage that voice of the heart, which is so important in our world. So a lot of it is just sitting and being quiet. My prayers are to calm my mind, and to be available or aware of that voice as it's speaking. So a lot of times when I'm sitting with the fire, I'll sit and I'll write. And what I do is I will ask a question of the fire and then write whatever answer comes through me. Now, it's important to note that I can't say that this is the voice of, the elemental god of fire, but it is how it's speaking through me at this time and place.
So, mm-hmm.
So those notes are things that are, for myself, for my own guidance and growth.
So what sort of things... Well, let me back up a little bit, because some of our listeners, I did talk to your brother Marakami, or I don't know how you refer to one another, but could you talk to us a little bit about what being a Marakami is and what took you there, how you got there, what drew you to it?
Well, a Marakami is a traditional healer, so one who has been chosen and trained through an apprenticeship to bring healing and a perspective of heart to the people. So part of what I do is giving counsel, especially in regard to life path and, you know, those sorts of things, but also to work directly with people's physical issues. Although I would say that what I'm doing as a healer is not really addressing the symptoms or even the illness itself, but the spiritual aspects that lie underneath the illness. You know, so in a lot of cases, there may be grief or anger or, you know, trauma that's unacknowledged or unexpressed, things like that, that need to be looked at and brought out, you know. And then in the healing process, we work to remove, you know, the impediments to open the doors of the heart and the other channels of the body so that the person can flow more freely in the world. So I forgot what the other part of your question was.
Well, that what drew you into this work and being a Mirakami specifically?
It wasn't anything that I chose to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very long story in terms of how I got there, but the short version is that my middle daughter was born dead.
And I'm so sorry.
Was for 10 minutes without heartbeat or breath, but was pulled back, and we were able through a lot of, well, essentially by not listening to the doctors who were, you know, right in their perspective that she would be, unable to eat or speak or hear or talk or walk or anything like that. You know, their goal was for us to let her go,
mm-hmm.
which we're willing to do. But we actually had an intervention by a Qigong master who brought her back. And at the time she went into the hospital, I asked the attending physician how long it would be before she got out. And I said, what will it be, 2 weeks? And she said, Mr. Merritt, your daughter has suffered a grave injury to her brain. And if she gets out of here at all, it'll be at least 6 months. Well, through everything that we did, including raising a prayer that went around the world, we brought her home in 13 days.
Wow. So,
but she did and does have difficulties. And when she was about 2.5 years old, her mother sent, or Jennifer's mother, my wife's mother, sent Jennifer this book she'd found called Plant Spirit Medicine by Elliot Cowan.
Mm-hmm.
So Jennifer read the book and was interested in it and thought that maybe Elliot could do something to help Maya. And so she wrote to Elliot and asked if he could do something. He wrote back immediately and said, I don't do anything remotely, but if you come to Santa Barbara during these days, then I'll see what I can do. So we went down to Santa Barbara and saw Elliot, and he looked at Maya and he looked at us, and he said to us, you know, Maya is a magnificent being, a goddess, mm-hmm. really, and, you know, there's nothing that she needs from me at this point, but you two could use some help in order to help her achieve her destiny. And so he began working on us. We were there for 5 days. And about the third day, he said, and I have to describe Elliot as a person of few words, pretty reticent to speak,
mm-hmm.
in certain ways. And he said, I don't know how to tell you this, but I keep getting this message that one of you, or maybe both of you, are called to this path of traditional healing, or to this spiritual path, he said. Didn't realize even what it was at the time. And he said, I think it's you, pointing to me. And I said, well, that's interesting. What can you tell me about it? And he said, well, I can't really tell you anything about it except for that it's very difficult and dangerous. And once you start, you can't stop. And
just to tempt you in, right?
Yeah, and I said, well, what would happen if someone started and did stop? And he said, well, I don't know, but probably you would die.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer raised her hand and said, I'll do it. So at the time, you know, I had no idea about shamanism. I had some very limited contact with it. I didn't feel that it was something I was called to. Jennifer went down to Mexico. I should say Elliot called her like 5 months later and said, okay, when you get to peak, call this number, you know, and gave us some of the fasting protocols to prepare for the pilgrimage. And so she went, and it was actually the first time that I was alone with Maya and at the time she was the only child in the house. I have an older daughter who's 29 living in Los Angeles by a previous marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And so she went down. I was crawling the walls, you know, crazy, thinking that I may never see her again. We didn't know where Topeak was, you know.
Right.
But she came back on time and said, it was really magnificent, but I can't tell you anything about it. But I really feel you should do this. So the time came for me to go to my pilgrimage, and I went, and I was skeptical, dubious, you know, feeling pretty separate from the people. There was a fiesta there for Elliot having completed one of his sites,
mm-hmm.
and about 40 people at that fiesta prior to the pilgrimage, and the fiesta ended, and the pilgrimage people left. And Elliot called those of us who were at the pilgrimage together and said, I need to tell you all that the pilgrimage is going to be one day longer than we had said, and so you need to make arrangements for that. At the time, I was working as a floor covering salesperson, a job that I absolutely loathed,
mm-hmm.
but it was what was supporting our family at that time, since Jennifer's practice as a naturopathic physician and acupuncturist hadn't started really well. It takes years to get that going. And I couldn't imagine staying. I couldn't risk that. And I went to Elliot and I said to him, you know, I'll stay for the time that we've allotted, but I've got to go back. I'll do everything there is to do, but I've got to go back. And Elliot looked at me and said, well, you know, this is a way to help your people, and there are a lot of ways. So if it's not for you, then go. Go now. So I went down to the nearest phone, which was about a mile and a half away, and called up Jennifer, who was staying at her sister's house across the bay. My pilgrimage site is at what we call Mount Tamalpais in California, the mountain north of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I called her and told her I was going to have to leave, and that she should come back the next day and talk to her and pick me up. So I went back. I was pretty dejected. And when I got back to the camp, people were talking about grandfather coming, talking in whispers, grandfather's coming tonight. And I didn't know what this was, but they permitted me to stay. And there was a man there who I'd met previously who was dressed in Huichol Traje, traditional costume,
mm-hmm.
and smoking cigars. And at length, something came over him, and this other energy or entity, what we've come to know as Grandfather Fire, in Huichol called Tatuari, came speaking through him. And I can't remember exactly what the words were that he spoke that night, but something in me was deeply touched,
mm-hmm.
and opened up. And since I was at that point not even a visitor, I was dismissed early while there was other business to do with the pilgrims. And in the morning, I woke up and early before dawn, and I ran down to the phone and I called up Jennifer, who was just about to have breakfast. I should say that part of the fasting protocol involves both the husband and wife.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just about to have breakfast, her favorite breakfast of lox and bagels, had the bagel in her hand, and she said, "Oh, I thought it might be you." So she hadn't yet broken her fast, and I went back and told Elliot that I'd like to stay, and he looked at me kind of dubiously and said, "Well, I guess so." And then I was in. So I guess to answer the question, I wasn't really looking for it. I didn't believe that it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
No experience with it. And yet I couldn't resist the call. Having that primary encounter with the divine was something that I couldn't ignore. And so that was, that was 2000, March.
Wow.
2000. And so we've been walking this path ever since.
That's very beautiful, and it's very shamanistic in that you're called to it, and sometimes by the need to heal the need to heal oneself in order to be present and be available to heal one's people, and that it's not voluntary.
I mean, yeah,
you can choose to participate, but the call is, being called is not voluntary.
Right, it's not voluntary, and a lot of people have wanted to engage in this path, not really knowing what is required, and a lot of people have not been permitted to join, you know, because it's really all in the hands of the gods. It's not what our human desires might be.
Right, and it's not always an easy path.
No, very challenging, you know, because as you say, one needs to engage those things in themselves that are keeping them from flowing freely in the world. And that's a lifelong journey to continue engaging it, because things happen, right? And
mm-hmm.
So when, especially when you're dealing with, Grandfather Fire, who has intimate knowledge of who we are, there's no way to hide.
Right.
So it's not like going to, sort of what we call neo-shamanism, where people have learned different techniques to engage with the unseen world and are working in that way. And that can be a good and effective way to work. But this is actually dealing with the reality of physical presences, divine beings as they express themselves as mountains and as the ocean, as forests and lakes and springs and deserts and caves and rocks, you know, and of course as plants and animals and other people.
Right.
So yeah, it requires all of us who've walked this path have been stripped down and singled out, you know. And, you know.
And how?
You know, there's a poem by Charles Wright called Clear Night, and there's a section of the poem that goes, "I want to be bruised by God. I want to be strung up in a strong light and singled out. I want to be entered and picked clean," you know. And
if you ask for it, it will happen.
That's essentially what we signed up for.
Mm-hmm. And how has that transformed your life?
Well,
or how has it transformed you, perhaps, is the
Our lives and we ourselves have been completely transformed. I have to say that at the time that we were called, I was pretty uncertain that our marriage would survive. I was really unhappy in my life, working a job I hated, although I had to continue working that job for another 7 years. because there was something there that needed to be taught to me through that work. I was living without many friends. I was sad and mostly depressed. And I'd say that most of those things have cleared up. I have a strong and loving community around me. My marriage is strong. We have another child that was born, 3 years into our pilgrimage path. A boy who's 11 now, Eli. We have a beautiful house things are working beautifully. And most important of all, I'm doing work that I feel is powerfully beneficial to the people who are engaged and in to the world as a whole. You know, just the fact of us making pilgrimages to these sacred sites, mm-hmm. you know, something that is gone from our culture, you know, and reawakening and those sacred sites, it has effect on the whole world, or, you know, or at least the areas in which those beings manifest, you know. So I would say that things have been utterly transformed, you know, I'm mostly joyful in my existence and happy to be doing what I have to do.
It's very beautiful. So what I hear is that you went from a life where there was very little heart to a life that is full of heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I just had to, a piece of wood had rolled out of the fire and push it back in.
Can you describe your fire? Just so, is it big? Is it?
Well,
how size?
I have a fire pit in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's paved around with flagstones.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a 24-foot circle, and the fire pit is about 42 inches across.
Mm-hmm.
I have a relatively small fire right now because the weather is nice and it's not yet. Dark. I've consecrated the fire with offerings, and so it has a certain presence and energy to it that's unlike what you might have at a campfire.
Mm-hmm.
Although I have to say that anytime people sit around fire, it's a good thing.
Yes.
This is something that is basic to our existence as humans. And can be said that when fire gave itself into our life, then we were able to thrive. Before that, we had a pretty hard time, born as we are without fur to protect us from the sun and from the cold, or fast legs to help us run, or fangs and talons to help us catch food. Pretty strange beings, really, for this earth. But once we had fire, then we were able to warm ourselves and to cook our food and to make tools for catching animals. And most important of all, had a source that could help us connect with the divine.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the traditions have risen out of the fire, or from people being able to listen to that sacred being. And so my fire, I've just got, right now I've got a couple of chunks of hardwood on it and a few pieces of fur, putting those together so that they burn nice and cleanly. Yeah. So that's what the fire is tonight.
That's beautiful. I had somebody tell me once that he had heard that the basic appeal of television is that it can simulate fire. It is a source of light that people sit around, but it doesn't fill the same need.
No, it's a kind of a cold fire. And you know, one of the things that, that we've done as humans is sit around the fire and tell stories, and talk to each other. And the problem with television, of course, is that nobody's talking but the TV, you know. And so while we sit around that fire, we may sit around it together, but we're essentially isolated in our own experience of that, of that talking box, you know. It reminds me, I saw a cartoon in this magazine, Funny Times, not long ago, and it was a caveman in a cave sitting by a fire, and his wife is standing by him with her hands on her hips, and he says, "I don't know, honey, I could just stare at this thing all day."
Yeah.
That's how we are with TV, right? And in a certain way, that's how fire captivates me. You know, I can spend hours just sitting and looking at the fire. And sometimes when we have our fire circles here, we'll spend time just sitting and looking at and listening to the fire. And then and seeing what it is that we experience, you know, talking about what it is we experience as we sit and listen and look at that dancing form.
Well, and for millennia, what was the center of a home was the fire.
Yes, of course, you know. And usually the fires were actually in the center of the home so that people would gather around it to eat, as well as cook. And, you know, it's really relatively recent that we had these boxes in the wall that we call fireplaces. But those are good, too.
Mm-hmm.
What one of the things that grandfather's fire says is that it's important for people to get wood smoke on them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to have that it's a nourishing smoke. You know, it's something that most of us don't get on a very regular basis.
No, it doesn't really fit into contemporary life very well.
No.
And how has your view of the world changed since you've become a fire tender? And is tomorrow very different because of having spent this night doing this and this preparation and this time listening and bearing witness or being present to all the other entities that inhabit this gorgeous planet with us?
Well, you know, I guess that my life as a whole is different. I'll be different tomorrow, partly because of the fatigue of staying with the fire all night. And also I have some work to do tomorrow, some ceremonial work to do tomorrow that will be, well, I actually enlivened because I sat by the fire tonight. Yeah, it does some good things. I would say that my, you know, I was living as most people live in our culture in a world of fear, where I was called to the fire. And while fear arises, you know, I'm not immune to anything that is part of the human experience. While fear arises, you know, I'm not controlled by or captivated by that fear. You know? And so I think living in a much freer and more connected way than I was prior to being called to this path. And then, of course, keeping a fire for other people, having the community fire has given me, some deep connections with people who are become very dear to me, you know, none of whom I knew prior to being called. And, so it's utterly, like I said earlier, utterly transformed my life. to not be afraid of things like death,
mm-hmm.
or to not be caught up in this dialogue about what might happen if I do something, but rather to be engaged in a way that I do what needs to be done, right?
Right.
And you know, and then if something goes awry, then I deal with that thing, right? If someone, you know, if I'm injured or something, then I deal with that injury. And so I guess the basic aspect of that is that my level of suffering has decreased a great deal. You know, because suffering is really the story that we tell ourselves about what has happened to us, as opposed to just engaging with it, you know. So there's a, like, for instance, William Blake has in his Proverbs of Hell, in the Marriage of Heaven and Hell,
mm-hmm.
the Proverbs of Hell, he has a proverb that says, the fox curses the trap, not himself. And too often in our culture, if something goes awry, then we spend a lot of time going, oh, why did this happen to me? You know, what did I do wrong? Or where am I, you know, why am I such a bad person and all that? And mm-hmm. so that whole conversation has pretty much disappeared from my life, where it was a basic part of how I expressed myself in the world, previously.
That's very powerful. It's very beautiful, but that's a very powerful shift to have moved from that place of that voice that runs so many people in this world to where you are.
I should say that I'm not immune to that voice, but I recognize it just as a voice. That's the voice of the mind, the voice that wants to control things, that wants to protect at all costs against loss, the voice that wants to look everywhere for danger. I don't really look for danger anymore. If danger approaches, then I deal with that. But again, I'm not immune to having that voice arise in me.
Mm-hmm.
So part of our human condition. But there's a stronger voice and a steadier voice, which is the voice of the heart, which knows who we are and what our purpose is, and knows that this life is just one aspect of the eternal arc of our soul, and that we are moving through as a divine expression in this world of infinitely diverse divine expressions. So part of the paradox of our life is that the divine is both one and infinitely diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming into recognition of that, that there are many, 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 many expressions of the divine, and that it includes us, is a really profound shift. As opposed to sort of a conventional way of looking at things, where where the divine is somehow separate from us, that God is this one big being that's out there that kind of kicked everything off, and that matter by its nature is evil, and that we need to aspire to connect with that one separate being that is the basis of all being. I'd say that we do need to connect to that one separate being, but that it is intimately engaged with all of us at all times, and with everything else that's moving in the world.
Right, that wholeness is, that it's all divine and sacred and speaks the language of the heart.
Mm-hmm. that heart connects everything, you know. That's where, you know, when we can quiet that voice of the mind, and there are many ways to do it. One is to sit and be with the fire. You know, I engage in, you know, daily, twice daily meditation practices. And, you know, and then, of course, in my work as a Merikami, you know, it's all about quieting the mind and listening to the heart. You know, what's speaking through the fire and in the wind and through, you know, I listen to the birds and to the person who I'm working with, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the minute that I go into a healing session with someone thinking I know what to do, then everything is lost. It's really important to go in there and be able to engage with that larger world that is expressed through heart. But, you know, as a person who's done a lot of reading and a lot of different works and things like that, when I started as a Merikami, that was the most difficult thing to learn, was that I didn't have the answers in my mind. You know, it mm-hmm. wasn't a matter, it isn't a matter of analysis, you know, of, you know, looking at this, looking at that, you know, creating a dialectic and finding a, the point of connection there. More a matter of looking at the whole of it and seeing what arises.
Yeah, and being receptive or listening or, but listening, we that's a single sense, and it's using all of your senses to.
Yes. So in my training as a Merikami, there are very few techniques that are taught.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's all about engaging with the sacred beings that we make pilgrimage to, learning to hear their voices or to recognize what we call their signatures
mm-hmm.
in the world around us, and to allow them to work through us. You know, but and so a lot of times when I'm working with people, I have to say I don't really know what I'm going to do or what I'm doing, except for to trust that what is being called for to do is the right thing. And so the people who I've worked with have, you know, pretty beneficial results. As long as they're open to receive the healing that they've come to seek.
Yes, because that's an important part too, is to even feel that you deserve to be healed.
Well, that's part of it, sure, is the person's openness to receiving the healing. And a lot of times, you know, people think that they want something, but they, when they are really confronted with what it is that they're looking at, then they don't necessarily want to go there. And so there's a little dance, you know. Part of it is, you know, helping people to prepare. Or to bring them slowly through the process so that the work can be, so that their hearts are open to receiving the kind of healing that is being offered. So I'd say it's very rare that, say, someone receives the, you know, full healing in one session, but it doesn't either take a whole long time. It's not like, say, psychoanalysis, where you might sit for 3 years with a person, you know, and still be hammering over the same story, you know.
Right, right. Well, then the story plays a very different role in this kind of healing.
Yeah, it does, because the story is in a lot of times, I know, say for myself, going back to you know, the fox cursing the trap, not himself, you know, that when things went bad for me, like it does for a lot of people, I had all these stories about why, things that had happened in my childhood, things that had, you know, not gone well as an adult. I remember one time going to Elliot, we were at a pilgrimage camp, and some things had been brought up during the camp that really shook me in a fundamental way, and a lot having to do with my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Elliot, and I said, Elliot, I need to talk to you. I'm really feeling bad. What's being talked about is bringing up this and this and this about my childhood. And Elliot said to me, look, I don't want to hear all that. What's going on for you right now? And I said, well, I feel sad and afraid and full of grief. And he said, okay, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the sadness that you feel right now. And we talked about that for a few minutes, and things went better. So the whole story that was lying behind that lifetime that I had constructed, which had become sort of my reason for not being able to do certain things, or for living in a world of fear, say it that way, Those were shown to be utterly inconsequential. Those stories are you know, just the things that we tell ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the reality of the present that we live in. You know? So, you know, no one is beating me these days. No one is humiliating me these days. Nor at that time when I went to Elliot. No one was hurting me in that way. Story that I told that brought up this sense of incapacity, you know. But when we live in the moment, when we're aware of where we are and what we're doing, then we have the ability to move freely and to overcome, you know, those difficulties, you know.
Well, I heard in that the grief and the pain got honored right there. The present grief and pain got,
yes,
listened to, and then we don't need to tell the stories to tell ourselves why it's there.
Right.
Just tend to the depth of the emotion and it.
Right. And to try not to suppress that emotion as it's arising, because a lot of the illness that we experience is the expression, is the suppression of our emotional lives. You know, we're taught to do that.
Yeah.
To not cry, especially as men.
Very much so.
Not cry and to you know, toughen it out and to you know, fight back and to, you know, so many things that we're taught. That are, and it's true for women too. It's true for everyone. You know, grief is almost a forbidden emotion in this culture. People die, and we have a funeral that's sort of like a, you know, kind of a nice quiet party.
Yeah.
Instead of you know, falling on the ground in grief at the loss of the person we love, you know, and allowing grief to flow through us like a tremendous storm that washes everything away, you know. Not that one would, you know, well, I should say it this way, that when grief arises, if it's not expressed, then it becomes depression.
Yeah.
And yeah. So see, we have at this time in our culture, so many people who are on medication for depression, when really what they just need to do is to express their grief or their anger or their, you know, or our anger, which when it's suppressed, will emerge as rage for people. So people, you know, get cut off in traffic and they want to kill the person who cut them off, you know, a completely out of balance response to a relatively trivial event, because they haven't been able to express their rage or their anger towards people for the insults that might have happened, you know, and anger being a boundary setting emotion, you know.
Right.
Hey, this is my spot, you know, stay back.
Respect, you know? Me. Yeah.
Respect me. And so a lot of what I look at in my work is what has been suppressed, you know, and how to bring forth those emotions so that they can move through, and then the whole emotional cycle, which is really our expression of being, can be engaged. But so many people are numb, you know. It's why these zombie movies are so popular these days, because they're really an expression of who we are as a people. You know, people walking without emotion, without really much awareness of the world around us, you know, just consuming things, you know, thinking that in that consumption we can somehow be filled. But but we're never really filled by that, you know. There's other things that fulfill us, mainly engagement with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that emotional suppression that we have as a fundamental aspect of our culture is really debilitating and causes so much unnecessary pain for so many people.
It's very beautiful, very beautifully said. And you cleared something up for me, because I have not understood the interest in zombies at all, but that makes perfect sense, because I know so many people who don't have access to their grief or their joy or their creativity or their pain or anything. You know, they don't.
So one of the things that one perspective that has grown in me as I've walked on this path is the perspective that the earth itself and everything on it is a vast flow of emotional expression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can look at rain, for instance. Is the rain coming down in, you know, great angry gales, or is it dropping, you know, gently as a blessing? You know, there's a wide range of emotions in the rain or the wind, or, you know, that are relatively easy to access. You know, but also, you know, how are the birds singing? You know, what's the squirrel saying? You know, and all those things. So sometimes when I'm working with somebody and I can feel that, say, compaction or condensation of emotion, that, you know, where they're not really able to speak freely, I'll listen to what the world is saying. You know, that is, how is the wind blowing?
Mm.
You know, are there suddenly chainsaws everywhere? You know, or you know, that kind of mechanical noise, or, you know, and those are part of what guide me towards seeing what the person needs. And, you know, one of the things that we've lost for the most part in our culture is the sense that the whole world is engaged with us. You know, that it's all listening and interactive. You know, where I live, I have in my front yard, I have a stand of cedar,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and I go walking in that stand, you know, pretty regularly, and just looking at the various forms of being that are living there, you know, and how they interrelate, you know, the fern and the cedars and the, you know, the big Douglas fir and, you know, how, you know, the rhododendron and the salal, all these beings that are, you know, utterly dependent on each other. But we, as humans, have told this story that somehow we're independent, that all this is not really, I mean, it's just commodity for us. It's just something for us to take. But a traditional way of looking at things is to actually recognize the life of everything that's around us and know that life is recognizing us as well. And so to live in relationship to that life, you know, to live in a way that nurtures all the life around us, recognizing that by nurturing that life, then our lives will also be nurtured. You know, that we're not alone. People, when they get into the forest, you know, I mean, I hear this all the time from people. I ask them, you know, when do you feel most alive and connected? And almost always it's in the forest or, you mm-hmm. know, or in the desert, in some quiet, natural setting. And most people can relate stories of how, you know, like they're walking along and suddenly one leaf in a tree is waving frantically at them or lovingly at them. You can use whatever adjective you want.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, most of us have that experience, but it's very hard to maintain in a city life where people are rushing by each other at such great pace and working so hard, you know, to just maintain a basic level of life, you know. And, you know, but so my advice for most people is to try to sit in a quiet setting, you know, at least a few times a week, you know, and spend, even if it's just for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, but just to sit and to listen to that livingness around them, you know, and to see how they fit into that.
That's a beautiful assignment.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really helps people to start to shed their sense of aloneness,
mm-hmm.
you know, their sense of being, you know, on their own in the world, you know, because the fact is that we can't do really anything on our own. We're utterly dependent on each other and, of course, on the earth itself. You know, the kind of, you know, Western mythology about, you know, that we're going to somehow be able to travel to another planet and establish life, you know, it's just a crazy idea, you know.
Yeah.
We have to learn how to live life here, you know. The only way that we can really live life here is through community and through connection with the living world around us, you know. There aren't going to be technological solutions to the ecological catastrophe that's confronting us. You know, when things fall apart, the only way that we're going to be able to survive is to learn how to live together, you know, in close community, and how to work with the land that is holding us, you know, in whatever place. And people have done this, you know, for, you know, 800,000 years or so.
Yeah.
People have lived in the most adverse climates. You know, here where I live in Portland in the Pacific Northwest, it's very rich, you know. Still plenty of water, you know, everything is green. You know, the people in this country, they didn't really have arts of war because they didn't need to. You know, everyone had plenty. you know. And so, you know, but as a Western person who hasn't been really schooled in how to live in a good way just in the land that we're living in, you know, it'd be very difficult, you know, if the transportation system went down and we couldn't get, you know, grapes from Chile.
Right.
Which, of course, I wouldn't eat those.
Right. And then there's places like I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it's very harsh here. It's very hard to make a living. And it's beautiful. It's very sacred.
Uh-huh. Yet people live there for
millennia. Yeah.
For many millennia, you know, in relative prosperity, you know. You know, I like to think about how I read an article not too long ago that was talking about how the hunter-gatherer people were taller, stronger, and healthier, and longer lived than we are, you know. And no doubt happier because they lived in intimate community with each other and with the world around them. It's the only way you could survive. But it's a pretty good life.
Well, and they didn't have this work to produce. It was participatory.
Yes.
So there was not that push and disconnect from the rhythms.
Yeah. It reminds me of a story where one of the things that every year we go up into the Huichol village of San Andres Bojamiada. It's very remote. It's about, 90 miles by air, either from Guadalajara or Puerto Vallarta. But driving there from either place is, 12 to 14 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So the people have been able to live there in you know, relatively untouched way, you know, having resisted both the conquistador and the missionary,
right,
and not having readily available mineral resources that would make it worth marching an army up through that incredibly difficult landscape, you know. But about 3 years ago, maybe 4 years now, the Mexican government brought electricity up into there. You know, they want to make a tax base up. And so with electricity, which, you know, we look at as a basic universal good, you know, of course it brings light in the night and it brings, you know, refrigeration, you know, those are things. But it also brought Western materialism in the form of television radio.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the first time in memory, the young people were no longer interested in doing the traditional initiations. And so they were having a very difficult time in that village. And so we went up there as we always do every year. And we have these beautiful grandmothers who are cooking for us, but this one man who had been, you know, good in helping us find our way there, decided that he wanted to have the money that we pay for his own family. So instead of hiring the grandmothers to cook for us, he had his children cooking for us. And they had bought a large quantity of apples, thinking that we as gringos want to have apples. And, you know, the apples were wormy and mealy, not very edible. And so one of our people said, well, I'll teach them how to make applesauce. And she has pretty good Spanish, so she was able to sit and work with them. And so as she's showing them how to make applesauce, they're asking her questions like, do you have a stove in your home? You know, is it gas or electric? And yes, I have. So do you have a refrigerator? Do you have, you know, a car? Do you have all these things, you know, a washing machine, you know, something that's completely unheard of up in,
mm-hmm.
Wichita country. And she, and after they asked her all these questions, she said, you know, it's true, I have all these things, but the simple fact is that when I cook by myself. When I do the laundry, I do it by myself. I'm alone all the time doing the things that you do together. And your life is so much richer because you have your community and your family with you all the time doing all these things, you know. And the young people were, you know, looking with wide eyes at her while she told this story, you know, and seeing that, you know, maybe there is something good about their lives, you know. And there were some older people there who were also listening, you know, with great interest at what she had to say, you know. And it's really, you know, when you think about the wealth that we've gathered, it's come at a tremendous cost. And that cost is the cost of community, you know. So many people, when they've gone, thought about going back to the land, have decided that they would try to do it on their own, and it's just impossible. You can't do it on your own.
No, you need a community.
You need the whole community. And so, you know, that's one of the things that we're working toward in the simple thing of gathering around the fire, is, you know, developing a community where people recognize each other and are feel safe to say who they are and to express themselves in a deep way.
It's very beautiful, Jonathan. I actually think that's a very beautiful place to end, if you're comfortable with that.
Sure.
It's a great gift for you to give back to that community to hold up the mirror of their beauty of their lives.
Yes. Yeah, when people come to our fire, you know, the fundamental thing is that we accept them absolutely as they are, you know, without qualification. You know, that here is this person, this expression of the divine, they're here with us, and we're lucky to have them.
That's so beautiful. We have been talking to Jonathan Merritt. How can people find you, Jonathan, if they're looking for you?
Well, I don't have a website, but they could reach me on my email address. Means it, a conflation of my wife and mine's name. So that's means it, MEANSITT at MSN.com.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, and have a beautiful night with your fire. Very
thank
grateful.
You. Thank you so much, Nika, and thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah.
Blessings to all of you who are listening.